Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, February 10th, 2020. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to National Liberty Alliance and click on our weekly call for the instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week with our Bible reading. We're in the Gospel of Mark, so we'll pick up where we left off. Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 13 through 31. And they brought young children to him, Jesus, that he should touch them, and his disciples rebuked those that brought them. But when Jesus saw it, he was much displeased, and said unto them, Suffer the little children to come unto me, and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of God. Truly I say unto you, whosoever shall not receive the kingdom of God as a little child, he shall not enter therein. And he took them up in his arms, and put his hands upon them, and blessed them. And when he was gone forth into the way, there came one running, and kneeled to him, and asked him, Good master, what shall I do that I may inherit eternal life? And Jesus said unto him, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God. Thou knowest the commandments. Do not commit adultery. Do not kill. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Defraud not. Honor thy father and thy mother. And he answered and said unto him, Master, all these have I observed from my youth. Then Jesus, beholding him, loved him, and said unto him, One thing thou lackest. Go thy way, and sell whatsoever thou hast, and give it to the poor, and thou shalt have treasures in heaven. And come, take up thy cross, and follow me. And he was sad at that saying, and went away grieved, for he had great possessions. And Jesus looked round about, and saith unto his disciples, How hardly shall they that have riches enter into the kingdom of God? And the disciples were astonished at his words. But Jesus answered again and said unto them, Children, now how hard is it for them that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God? It is easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. And they were astonished out of measure, saying among themselves, Who then can be saved? And Jesus, looking upon them, saith, With men it is impossible, but not with God, for with God all things are possible. Then Peter began to say unto him, Lo, we have left all, and I have followed thee. And Jesus answered and said, Truly I say unto you, there is no man that hath left house, or brethren, or sisters, or fathers, or mothers, or mother, or wife, or children, or land, for my sake, and the gospel, but he shall receive 100-fold now, in this time, houses, and brethren, and sisters, and mothers, and children, and lands, with persecutions, and in the world to come, eternal life. But many that are first shall be last, and the last first. That was the Gospel of Mark, chapter 10, verses 13 through 31. Okay, I'm going to do something a little different tonight. I'm sharing my screen. Anybody that's on a browser, are you seeing me coming through on the screen?
Yeah, I see it.
Okay. All right, so anybody that's got a browser or I guess even a smartphone, or I don't know, it'd be kind of tiny on a smartphone, but we're going to put out, we're going to look at a paper tonight. This is the next paper to be filed. And the paper after this one will probably be the IRS paper, which hopefully we're going to file within the next 2 weeks. So anybody who wants to get involved in that particular process and get their affidavit in, now's the time to really work on that and get that done. And all we're looking for is an affidavit, 2 pages, maximum. You know, we don't want to get too involved in too much storytelling. We just got to get the main facts, the details. I know everybody that's been harassed by the IRS, they've got, 100 letters or so. You know, I mean, they just don't stop. And they love, I'd like to find out if they do this to other people, because they do this to me all the time. It's like every year I expect a Christmas card from them. Of course, it's not a Christmas card, it's a bill. I mean, every single year, usually about the 19th to 20th of December, I get a nice letter from them. So they love to harass you. They love to get you down, even in the times when we should be, focusing elsewhere other than government and other things. So again, we don't need to go through all of the details, just the beginning, where it started, and kind of where you're at now with them, and a little bit of information in between, but not getting into all the details of all the letters and back and forth. It's just way too much. The main thing is that they're assaulting you without any information, without any proof. And when you write a letter, they don't respond to you. I mean, they keep writing you, but you write them back, but they never respond. That may not be 100% true. Sometimes they do. I know the last letter I sent them, they responded with, "Well, we got to think about this and give us 60 days and blah 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 blah." So we'll see what they're going to say after that. And they did that to me once before, I think. So I must have hit a nerve on that one, maybe. But anyway, affidavit should be short. If the numbers that they're asking for is ridiculous, which usually they are. I mean, first time they came out, they won $150,000 $250,000 in taxes. That's the tax, $250,000. These people are insane. All right, anyway. On our website, and we were on the Patriot Soapbox today. We have picked up a program timing as a host. And we will be on the Patriot Soapbox every Monday at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's 2 hours. I think today went pretty well. I'm not sure whether it was posted yet. Did you post that up, Jan, yet? Or anybody post
no,
that up?
No, not yet.
Where are you posting them? You're posting them under TV and radio interviews, right?
Right. I don't have the link yet.
Okay. All right, so anyway, are you posting under Reality Check, NLA Radio and TV and interviews, right?
Right.
Okay, so here's where we're posting these things. The one that's going to be posted up today or eventually, I believe, is an MP4, which will be a video as well as an audio, correct? It's going to show the desktop sharing, correct?
I've just posted the audio.
Okay, we'll see if you can get the... what is the audio, MP3?
Yeah, it's an MP3. The video is almost a gig, and it takes a year and a day for me to upload that.
What's that? The
MP4.
MP4?
Yeah, it's huge.
All right, well, then maybe we won't need it then if it's that big, because we don't want to pile all that stuff up on our website. But see if you can't put a copy for me over in my other file on the File Depot. And because I'd like to take a look at them to begin with, and maybe I'll create YouTube videos out of that. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Okay. So anyway, we're going to look tonight at a paper that we're going to be filing. This paper has just been finished. We have it on underneath grand jury action against the judiciary. We have it on that page. Come down a little bit, and you will see, let's see, right here, this is the Second Amendment draft. It hasn't been filed yet. It's a writ quo warranto, Second Amendment. Now, this is the second writ quo warranto we're filing, okay? We have been filing a lot of mandamuses. The first writ quo warranto we filed was the very first paper we filed, like two and a half years ago or so. And but this one, we're going to be talking from this point with these people with writ quo warrantos. Either respond, prove that you have the authority, or shut down the institution. And of course, we're not looking for them to shut down the institution of the Supreme Court, but we may vacate them if that's what's necessary. But that's not going to happen unless we get enough people behind us. We certainly have the ammunition, in the sense, in the words, to vacate them. And as I mentioned, I think I mentioned earlier, maybe it was off the air when I mentioned this, you know, they have created, and I'm sure most people realize this, they have created the right and the left, you know, the conservative against the liberals. It's all meaningless. You know, it doesn't mean anything to me when someone says they're a conservative. It doesn't necessarily mean they're a constitutionalist. All of us, we the people, are and should be constitutionalists. Unless we don't like our liberties, if we don't like our unalienable rights, then fine, be a conservative. But as for me, I'm a constitutionalist. And we need to make all of our servants constitutionalists. We don't want liberals. We don't want conservatives. We don't want the bickering and the fighting and the politics and the BS and the taking of money, you know, buying their vote, selling their vote. We got to get rid of all this stuff. And as long as we have right and left, and that argument, you know, of the conservative position versus the liberal position, as long as you keep having those two sides, they're just going to keep you busy while they're doing something else over here, and they're destroying everything our founding fathers put together. And we've come very close. We actually have lost. We have been enslaved. We've been enslaved since they initiated the tax on salaries. That's when we became enslaved. We have been taken over. There's an oligarchy behind our government, behind the administration, the presidency, with the exception of Donald Trump. I mean, he has kind of came in, and I'm sure they were afraid to approach him directly, and he's taken control, and they're shutting them down. Thank God. But they seized the White House back in 1963 when they assassinated JFK. And they've had control of it ever since. And any president who tried to step up to do anything, the last one who tried was Reagan. Very early in his presidency, they put a shot across his bow. But Trump, you know, he's uniquely qualified. And being a billionaire and a huge international businessman, involved with so many things, understanding economics and relationship between countries and all this stuff. And he's educated in these areas also, of course, formally educated beyond, of course, his experience education. And so he's uniquely qualified to do what he's doing. Not many people, I'm not aware of anybody who can do what he's doing, but I'm sure there might be someone out there, so not many people could do what he's doing. And so he's well positioned, and he's rubbed shoulders with all these people. He knows all these people. He knows where the skeletons are, and he stayed away from the evil, even though he was in their ranking, so to speak, you know, on their level, peers like, so on. But Trump has always preferred the people. People who live in New York City know that very well. He's always preferred being around the people, and rubbing shoulders more with people than with, you know, celebrities. Although he does, because he was a businessman. All right, anyway, we're going to look at this paper today. We did read it on the soapbox, Patriot Soapbox, and we're going to read it tonight because it's an important paper. It's a powerful paper. It's empowering. It's enlightening. And it's the next paper we're going to file. And I think it reveals a lot more of what we're doing, and the next paper is going to be similar to this in the sense of a writ quo vanto, and that one's going to be on the IRS. And then we'll have another one probably in about 2 weeks. We'll start working on another one. I did start working on one. I'm not sure when we're going to file that particular one, and it's more of a follow-up paper, you know, hopefully the knockout punch, you know. But at some point, we'll get one in there that eventually they'll be weak enough because they won't have anyone protecting them anymore, and we'll get the knockout punch. Okay, so let's take a look at this paper. So I'll open it up here on the in the browser, Rick Wolwano. It's the cover sheet, And we're focusing, and of course, you know, we've been in lawsuit against the United States, the Supreme Court, the federal judiciary, the United States Senate, the House of Representatives. That is, we've been doing that for 2 years, and every once in a while we add some additional individuals on here. In this case, we're adding on Governor Ralph Norum of Virginia, Virginia State Senate, Virginia State House of Delegates, also Governor Andrew Cuomo here of New York, because these two governors and these two both houses of both states are involved in a conspiracy. Ultimately, it's definitely a conspiracy because there's more than one person involved, and they're working together to destroy the law of the land. That's what they're doing. They're destroying the law of the land. They're trying to get rid of our Second Amendment. And we need to make it clear to them that there is a U.S. code that talks about those who will go after to destroy the law. And we're going to read that in this paper tonight. Also both houses in New York, New York Senate and the New York State Assembly. And those are the defendants. But what we came up with also on our next page is the Common Law Grand Jury's subversive watch list. They got a list, we got a list too. And these are all of the representatives that are on our list, okay? Most of them are Democrats, but there's some Republicans in there. I didn't have time to go up and put D's and R's in these names. Let's see, Francine, maybe you can get a hold of someone to put the D's and the R's in here, in parentheses, like we did on the New York State Senate and New York State Assembly, and then I'll swap them around, put the two new lists in. But anyway, these people here have all put votes towards things that are injuring our Constitution, things that are infringing upon our unalienable right to keep and bear arms. So we'll go down to the page where we started. It's not that long. It's about a 15-minute read. And again, a writ quo warranto. We will be copying the president. And also the Attorney General, William Barr. I saw a quote somewhere. I'm trying to think where I saw it, and I made some notes on it. So I might add something in here with the FBI. The FBI recognizes four categories of violent extremism. Okay, four categories. One, racially motivated violent extremism. Two, anti-government or anti-authority extremism. What is the authority that they act upon? Their authority is the Constitution, and they are anti-Constitution. We're going to send some papers to the FBI on this one. I think we're going to put this into the paper, and we're going to put them in as copied, and we're going to put a special letter in front telling them that they need to go and start doing some investigation for subversion. And the other two are animal rights, environmental extremism, and this one kind of puzzled me. I don't even know what this means, to be honest with you. I know what the words mean, but I don't know what they mean. Abortion extremism. I mean, I would think if you're going to say abortion extremism, I would think killing a baby when they're ready to be born, or half out of the womb, or now they can sit around for a couple of days or a week to make the decision to kill them or not. I don't know how long that is, but I know they were trying to push that law through. I'm not sure whether they got that here. In any event, I mean, that would be extremism. It's also called murder. And when a society doesn't recognize the murder of their own children, that puts us into a real sad state. I have been very concerned watching, as things are going on, that there are so many people that are still so deceived. Now, again, a lot of them have to be woken up yet, and they will be woken up. But the younger kids, particularly, we have a problem with the younger generation. They have no experience to begin with. They don't know what communism is. They don't know what socialism is. They don't learn about that in school. They have no idea that this is evil stuff, and it's destructive. And they're all being used just to get people in power, and then they're going to kill them off. After all, you know, those people, they went up against their own people. They betrayed their own people. They may betray us. We'll kill them too, at the end of the day. But anyway, extremism. We're probably going to add something to this paper on that for the FBI. Okay, so I'm going to read this paper, and we'll see where we go from there. And it appears that our elected and appointed servants need to be reminded that in America, we the people rule, we the people are sovereign, and that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of we the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new servants, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. In this world, lawful governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, and are therefore instituted to secure just courts, lawful legislations, and the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is what we the people ordained and established via the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. But rogue elected and appointed servants, knowingly and willfully, in violation of 18 U.S.C. 2383, having engaged and continuing to engage in insurrection against the law of the land, and seditious conspiracy is in violation of 18 U.S.C. subsection 2384, proven by the fact that many have organized themselves to dishonor their oath to support and defend our Constitution, and instead they are supporting and defending their repugnant agenda to overrule the people's God-given unalienable right to defend ourselves from such tyrants via Amendment 2. We the people, via Amendment 2, ordained and codified our unalienable right to a well-regulated militia and a reserved militia, armed with military-grade rifles, being necessary in order to secure free states from enemies both foreign and domestic. Militias always required military-grade weapons of the day. You cannot defend against an M16 auto or an AK-47 auto with a handgun or a hunting rifle. We the people, being sovereign, ordained and established under the Bill of Rights a well-regulated militia that normally operates, of course, under the authority of the president or governor when called to suppress insurrection or repel invasion under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15. And the reserve militia that operates under the auspices of the sheriff when called, rooted in long centuries of Anglo-American history, finding its beginning in Israel in 1400 B.C., the regular and reserve militia is a constitutional fixture in its own right. Its institutional relationship remains independent when defending our unalienable God-given rights from tyrants who have seized control of our governments. The militia, being we the people themselves, are separate from the states and federal governments, over whose functioning the states and federal governments do not control, in that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish. When communications between the people and their servants completely break down, the militia is the enforcement arm of we the people to bring them back under the chains of the Constitution. Without the militia, liberty will be lost. George Mason's speech in Virginia ratifying convention in 1788, he said, "When the resolution of enslaving America was formed in Britain, the British Parliament was advised by an artful man, who was governor of Pennsylvania, to disarm the people, that it was the best and most effectual way to enslave them, but that they should not do it openly, but weaken them, and let them sink gradually, by totally disusing and neglecting the militia." Today our servants tell us that in order to be free and secure, it is necessary for us to give up our arms and trust them with our security and safety. But history has shown us that necessity is the plea for every infringement of human freedom. It is the argument of tyrants. It is the creed of slaves. As Benjamin Franklin said, "They that give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserves neither liberty nor safety." True liberty in this world is rare, and history recalls that it was gifted and lost only once from 1400 BC to 1000 BC by the nation of Israel. And in 1776, it was gifted a second time to the people who are called by his name, Israel. Today, it is the duty of the people to secure liberty before it is lost again. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 28, we read, God blessed his children and commanded them to subdue the earth. We will never let the weight of the deep state endanger our liberties, our republic, or a democratic process. We should take nothing for granted. We must guard against those who for millennia strived to possess our land by deceit and by force and fill the face of the world with their dark cities. It is the people's duty to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. The history of our servants within our present government, like our founding fathers of yesterday, is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states. To prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. On September 25, 2013, Secretary of State John Kerry, in an act of war against the unalienable rights of the people protected by the Second Amendment, against the will of we the people and without our consent, committed treason by covertly signing the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, thereby surrendering the people's unalienable right protected by the Second Amendment to foreign powers hostile to liberty. On September 24, 2014, Barack Obama, while addressing the UN General Assembly concerning the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty, in an act of war against the unalienable rights of the people protected by the Second Amendment, against the will of we the people, said, all nations must meet our responsibility to observe and enforce international norms, thereby covertly yielding his oath of office to foreign powers. On December 24, 2014, Christmas Eve, the United Nations Arms Trade Treaty covertly became binding on the nations that had ratified it, signed by John Kerry. Under fiction of law, the treaty provides the basis for additional gun regulations in America under the guise of necessity. On April 30, 2016, Barack Obama, at a White House Correspondents' Dinner speech, said, the end of the republic has never looked better. A League of Evil. The following statistics were reported in the September 11, 1999 issue of The Economist magazine, page 7, titled A League of Evil. 1915 to 1917, Ottoman Turkey banned gun possession and then targeted Armenians, mostly Christian, and killed 1 to 1.5 million people. 1927 to 1949, Nationalist China banned private ownership of guns and then targeted political opponents, army conscripts, and others, killing 10 million people. 1929 to 1945, Soviet Union banned gun possession and then targeted political opponents and farming communities, killing 20 million people. 1933 to 1945, Nazi Germany and occupied Europe banned gun possession and then targeted political opponents, Jews, Gypsies, and critics, killing 20 million people. 1949 to 1952, 1957 to 1960, 1966 to 1976, Red China instituted the death penalty for supplying guns to counter-revolutionary criminals. And anyone resisting any government program and then targeted political opponents, killing 20 to 35 million people. 1960 to 1981, Guatemala banned gun possession and then targeted Mayans, other Indians, and political enemies, killing 100,000 to 200,000 people. 1971-1979, Uganda, registered gun owners, instituted warrantless searches and then targeted Christians and political enemies, killing 300,000 people. 1975 to 1979, Cambodia registered gun owners and then targeted educated persons and political enemies, killing 2 million people. 1994, Rwanda registered gun owners and then targeted the Tutsi people, killing over 800,000. Unarmed people have no defense against a demonical government. In the 20th century alone, governments killed a total of 262 million civilians. Nobel Peace Prize finalist R.J. Rummel, in an update to statistics originally presented in his Death by Government, Transaction Publishers, 1994. We the people would like to remind our elected servants of Virginia and New York and other states of the Declaration of Rights via the Virginia Constitution made by the good people of Virginia in the exercise of their sovereign powers, which rights do pertain to them and their posterity as the basis and foundation of government, which states, Section 1, equality and rights of men, that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights of which they, when they enter into a state of society, they cannot by any compact deprive or divest their posterity, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty, with the means of acquiring and possessing property and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Section 2. People, the source of power. That all power is vested in and consequently derived from the people, that magistrates are their trustees and servants, and at all times amenable to them. The United States Constitution is clear that the federal and state governments have no authority to infringe upon we the people's unalienable right to keep and bear arms, including automatic military-grade weapons. This is an unalienable right, and therefore cannot be altered by statute or amendment. Any elected or appointed servant who ignores their oath and uses their office of trust to prevent, limit, or infringe in any way the people's Amendment 2 will be met with indictments for engaging in insurrection against the laws of the United States in violation of 18 U.S.C. subsection 2383, which states, whoever incites, sets on foot, assists, or engage in any rebellion or insurrection against the authority of the United States or the laws thereof, or gives aid or comfort thereto, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 10 years or both, and shall be incapable of holding any office under the United States. Furthermore, our founding documents establish the one and only lawful government in that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government. No other type of government is lawful and just. The United States Constitution expresses a balance of power that is self-evident and cannot be violated by rule, statute, or amendment. To violate said balance would render the United States Constitution feeble, thereby requiring a revamping of all our founding documents and a loss of natural law. That self-evident balance of power in one level is between the three branches well-defined in Articles 1, 2, and 3. On another level, it is a self-evident balance of power between the federal government, state governments, and we the people, well-defined in the 10th Amendment. Any legislation that upsets the balance of power, such as the 14th, 16th, and the 17th Amendment, is null and void. We the people's unalienable rights, such as the Amendment 2, are non-negotiable, because unalienable rights are gifted by our Creator and not given by man. Not the legislators, not the judiciary, not the executive, and not even the people. In short, no man can void an unalienable right. Only God can void his blessings of an unalienable rights. Any elected or appointed servant that uses their elected or appointed office of trust to incite, assist, or engage in any rebellion or insurrection against the law of the land is in bad behavior, and thereby shall be removed from office and tried for treason in a natural law court. People have a right to think and believe as they will. But when you are entrusted with an office of trust, either by election or appointment, and you take an oath to uphold and support the Constitution for the United States of America, you have a duty and are expected to lay your personal opinions aside and uphold your oath. If you cannot do the just thing, you must resign. And if you do not resign, we will assist you with an indictment. Therefore, if you use your office of trust to war against the people's unalienable right to keep and bear arms protected by Amendment 2, you war against a self-evident law granted by God that can never be altered, and you will be guilty of insurrection. The tribunal orders, via our prerogative of writ quo warranto, that the defendants give an account of their stewardship and cease and desist from using their office of trust that they occupy to incite and engage in insurrection against the law of the land, or resign. All state and federal legislators have 30 days to undo legislation or be in the process of undoing legislation that infringes on the people's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Justice will prevail, our indictments will be honored, and our warrants will be executed. Transparency of government and the law and order must prevail in order to save the only one true lawful republic. No one is above the law. A partial truth is no truth at all. A partial law is no law at all. And a partial right is no right at all. Obey, resign, or face the charges of insurrection. Your choice. It is so ordered, dated Albany, New York, and sealed by the grand jury administrator. Okay. Well, let me stop.
1915 to 1917.
Ottoman Turkey banned gun possession and then targeted Armenians, mostly Christian. Okay, I guess I didn't erase that at the end of that one. Okay, we're going to open up in a couple of minutes. Is Brent here, by the way? And Gerard, are you here? I'm going to try to stop.
Brent's here.
Okay, Brent. I will be with you shortly. I just wanted to shut off sharing screen. I have the screen's no longer sharing, correct?
Correct.
Okay, good. I should have made mention to those who are coming in through the apps that we provide that there is a place you can go and click on the wall. Maybe people know that already. I don't know. But they click on the wall, and then you're able to view what we're showing. I think that's how that works. I'm not sure. Or maybe it just does. Did it automatically jump on the wall that people may open automatically, or no? Does anyone know that?
Yeah, it doesn't jump up in your browser. It jumps up on a separate screen that Start Meeting is running.
Oh, okay. So as soon as I start to share, a browser opens in their computer for them, and they can see what we're looking at, correct?
Not a browser. It opens up a separate window that's another piece of Start Meeting.
Oh, okay. All right, so anybody that's coming in through an app will see it that way, I presume. Okay. All right, so if I'm no longer sharing, because I'm going to put other things up on this screen, so that's... Let me do that first before we move on and see where we're at. Okay. All right, we do have a few people in the queue. We'll get to them shortly. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1. And let's keep an eye out for Crystal. Crystal, if you're here, get into the queue. We'll try to pull you up first. Star 6 and a 1 to get into the queue. Jan, do we have any announcements or do we have any questions?
We have, I guess, one announcement and about 2.5 pages of questions. The announcement is we're down possibly to needing 2 people for leadership in the Committeeman Militiaman Project. The 2 areas that are left are areas 6 and 7. And area 6 is for Illinois, Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas. And areas, 5 would be the other one, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Nebraska. Now, you don't have to live in those areas to take that position. You can live anywhere around there, or, as we all know, we're scattered all over the map anyway. You could even be cross-country, and it would not be a problem.
As long as the time difference doesn't bother them.
Yeah.
Affect them, yeah.
Well, see, they're in the middle. It can only go an hour either way.
Well, that's true, yeah. Well, actually, 2 hours when you go to the west, no? Isn't there mountain time?
Only
and then
one. Well,
only one.
I guess it is to clear the west coast, yeah, from the Midwest. And that's the only announcement. Other than you already mentioned that you have a regularly scheduled show now on Patriot Soapbox, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern each Monday. And then also every other Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. And if you check the newsletter, I have 3 different links there you can go to watch John, and eventually Gerard's going to have one of his own too, but we haven't got it scheduled yet.
Yeah, Gerard said that he was looking to take Wednesday, so probably going to be Wednesday, but we'll find out from him. And he's not going to be starting this week. If anything, he'll probably start next week, hopefully. And Brent also has taken up a position there too, so this is good news. You know, look at, I've been watching some of this stuff, but only a couple of programs. And they give some good information and news and stuff, but they're not being educated. You know, at least, you know, with the three of us working over there, we can start educating these people and getting them involved and giving them the necessary tools to take this nation back. And so we're going to be talking with them. I know Brent, I'm sure, will be talking very heavily on the militia. We will be, too. We'll be talking about, of course, the courts and the systems and the problems in the courts and, of course, the committeeman process. And I'm sure Brent's going to cover a lot of those things and also probably the Constitution. The people desperately need a proper education. And so we're going to do our best to give them this education and to convince them to step up and get involved. You know, there's a lot of patriots over there, you know, we need to even shake them off of their seats to get involved, because a lot of people think, well, the other guy's doing it. I'm here to tell you the other guy's not doing it. Step up and let's do it. We need more activity. We need more help. You know, I saw an email come through, and they were concerned because it was taking a long time to get the papers filed and certain dates have passed and so on and so forth. Well, we don't have enough help, so we're behind. But just like the court system anyway, and they got a lot of help, but nevertheless, just like the court systems, you know, they have deadlines and they go past them. I've been in courts waiting 6 months to get an answer of something from the judge where, you know, they said they'd get back in a month or two, or soon. I don't think they ever really say, well, last judge I saw in a federal court did say he'd get back in a month. He never did. He never did at all, period. And you know, responding to making decisions. But in any event, hopefully a lot of those people will wake them up and they'll come over here, they'll join us and support us and get educated and take positions and take back their nation by consenting to their government on the grassroots level. And we will endeavor to do all that we can to teach them everything they need to know in order to do that. You know, National Liberty Alliance does not have any intentions or desire to be some kind of a national leader. We are we are here to facilitate people with an education, an organization, and a communications, so that you can communicate from one end of the country to the other and organize from one end of the country to the other, but remain grassroots. Your power and the power of the people is on the grassroots level. On the county level is where we're building. We're building the militia up on the county level. We're rebuilding, of course, the regular militia needs to be rebuilt. So we're going to restructure the regular militia because, of course, the National Guard is not operating properly, and they're too much under the thumb and the control of the federal government. And after all, the federal government took them out of the country and sent them over to the Middle East, and they did not sign up for that. And a lot of the military leadership tried to make arguments again to their governors and others, saying they didn't have the constitutional authority to remove the militia from the land. We're here to deal with insurrections and revolts. Okay, that's what we're here for. We're here to protect the borders. We're here to fight on our land if necessary. we're not here as a regular army to go over there. Again, we need to reconstruct it from the bottom up. We do have a plan on that. You know, when we have six people interested in the militia and they're well organized and they get together and they do their resolutions and they adopt a uniform rules that we've put together, once they have done that and they get a little educated on how to talk with the sheriff and approach the sheriff, we'll give them the materials, everything they need to do that, and then how to bring the sheriff on board in a way that he cannot deny it. And he'll say, we have to operate properly and put ourselves under the auspices of the sheriff when called, okay? And then from there, I forget the numbers exactly. I got to go back and review some of the things that Brent put together. But I'm going to take some guesses on this. The state, each county needs to be cut up into three pieces with I think it's this way. And X amount of people in each one of those three pieces. I think it was 100 or 300. But once we get a certain number of people in the whole county, maybe 600, 900 or something of that nature, when we reach a certain point, that's when they then have to deliver themselves up to the governor and be under, being provided for by the government for different things and also to become the actual regular militia. And, a lot of this stuff, we still need to work some of this out and how we could do this. And of course, as I mentioned, Brent has written a book on this, and I'm sure he'll give us a lot of advice on this and correction when necessary. But we have to be very careful of what we're doing. We have to do it lawfully, constitutionally, and by right, the right of the people to do it. We have to come with power and authority and boldness. Because if the people come in meekly, we're going to be walked on. We got to be bold. And remember, the deep state is being drained out of the swamp and destroyed. And once that falls, we need to take advantage of that and be the boldest we can be. We need to build that up. We need to build up the committee man process and get committee men across this nation to take back the political process. And the administrators to take back the judicial process, and then, and only then, will the people, when we can accomplish this goal, and it could happen very quickly, it could happen within a year, if we get the critical mass. It all depends on that critical mass, and the critical mass coming in, involved, connected, being educated, preparing, doing, and not sitting and listening, but doing. But we have to have confidence, and by studying, and studying these papers that we write, it should empower you. Give you boldness. I remember whenever the IRS has been on my case for 25 years. They've been come and gone for 25 years with me. And, every time I used to get the letters, you go through a stress. You don't want to open it up, but you got to open it up. And you let it sit there. I'll deal with it tomorrow. I'll get to it next week. I'll wait till the weekend. And before you know, you start to acquiesce if you continue like that. I've never acquiesced, but I've come close. But finally, you open it up. And I've learned from doing this. Once you open it up, you say, okay, this is what they're saying. You start to study, do a little research, pull the stuff together, and respond. And then you feel empowered. Then you feel protected. You feel that you have neutralized everything that they said in that paper. And you have taken control of the narrative and turned it back to them. You're not giving me the information. Where is the law? By what authority is this? And where does this bill come from? Can you give me a breakdown to begin with? Can you give me a proof of a claim? I mean, give me something. Okay. You see, I always mention, I intend on being a law-abiding person. I want to obey the law. But I'm not just going to open my doors to just anyone or any government official, and I'm not going to open my pocketbook to any government official and just let them take what they want. No. Show me. Tell me. Explain to me. You see, they can't do that. And I think that has been a major thing that has really kind of kept me just a step ahead of them. But In any event, they're dangerous people, and they come out and assault the people, and we need to deal with that problem. Don't let anything not be answered. You must answer. Okay, we're not going to take too many questions. I'm definitely not a page and a half, Jan, but we'll take maybe two or three, and then we'll hopefully pick up on them next week. How many questions do you actually have?
Oh, probably a dozen or 15.
Well, we can't take that many. Let's take a couple.
Okay.
You know, by the way, when we come to the end of the program, which is usually rare lately, but sometimes we get to the end of the program and we still have some time and there's nobody in the queue, maybe at that point we should pick up some of these questions there too, you know? But let's do a couple. Let's see how fast we can go through some of them, and then I don't want to spend too much time on it.
Okay. Do you know or do you have a template for court proceedings? I need to file in federal court and do understand what to ask, but do not know how to ask, meaning what is a show cause notice, proof of damages, and so on. In other words, I need a little assistance with parallel things.
Well, I hate to say it, but I want to be honest and true. It sounds like you need a lot of assistance, and that's a problem. You need to become educated. You know, there are certain things you could do to kind of slow the wheels. You know, you can file certain papers. You can file challenge jurisdictions. You could move it to federal court for cause. There's a lot of things you can do. Maybe you're already in federal court, I don't know. But there's a lot of things you could do to kind of buy more time. And I would think that, you know, that easily you can buy 90 days. Now, that means what are you going to be doing in those 90 days? You're going to become educated. And if you don't become educated and understand the process and the procedure and how things work, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. And it depends on who you're going up against, too. I mean, there's certain pieces of knowledge that is not known by many people, and especially with the IRS. But there's little tidbits that most people don't know. Very few people don't know. Very few people know. And you need to know those things. You need to understand that you need to control the narrative. You need to keep them on the defensive. If you're on the defensive, you're losing. If they're controlling the narrative, you're losing. That's how you can tell what's going on in the court. Now, it is true that if the judge is going to try to make a ruling, you're going to lose anyway. And if they have a padded jury, you're probably going to lose anyway also. But not necessarily so. Because, again, you get the opportunity representing yourself. You can then get up and talk to the jury. But you have to be able to articulate yourself well. You have to be well prepared. You have to neutralize everything that the other side says. You have to turn it back onto them. Okay? So what I would say is you go to our website and start getting educated. Immediately take the consent of government course. That's a no-brainer first thing, because that is going to give you the proper framework of your mind, in your mind, to be able to start working in the courts. So the faster you can get through that course, and by the way, we've already had somebody who's already gone through the entire course, so they went through it very quickly, so anybody can do that also. 90 days is really a lot of time, but, you know, don't drag your feet, don't put it off to a month, I'll get to it later. No, start right away. Get educated now. But get through that course. I would also do the civics course, and that's a 120-hour course, but I would do that secondly, and that tells you pretty much, reveals a lot about the enemy to begin with. Shows us how we got here. It gives a lot of history, also some information on common law courts and how things work in that thing. We've got quite a few lectures on that, and various other things, a lot of documentaries. And by the end of the day on those two courses, you're going to be well-equipped. I mean, I'm sure you're not going to be able to recall a lot of it, but you'll have the proper frame of mind to now be able to take the actions that you have to take in the court, the papers you have to write, the information you'll need. And then you can also draw off of our memorandums. You know, you can... hold on a minute. Stop. Okay, I'm not sure what that's about, stopping the video, but... And let me just click OK on whatever that's at. Kind of lost my where I was at. Anyway, take those courses. Now, what you want to do is go up to our website, of course, nationallibertyalliance.org, okay? And underneath education, all right, you have court forms, processes, and instructions. You click on that, and it's got a lot of good stuff in there. But I do not. I am strongly suggesting if you don't have the framework of knowledge in order to go into these courts, and you don't have the education to be able to understand the process and the procedures of the court, you're really making your chances of winning very, very low. You're not going to. It's the David and Goliath, but you don't have your stones with you and your slingshot. So, it's a big problem. But we have instructional forms on challenging the jurisdiction. We have instructions on forms on moving your case for cause, instructions and forms to file habeas corpus, how to move a court for enforcement, notice and demands, and downloads of different things concerning common law. We have a lot of memorandums that you can download on this page, PDFs and words that you can use and build your case with it. All of our papers have a lot of footnotes in it, a lot of footnotes. And so when you read through our papers, there's certain statements and certain things that we quote that you can say, whoa, I can use that for my case. So you cut and paste it out and drag the footnote along with it, and you build your paperwork. But again, if you're looking for a form and to go in there and perform a one-trick pony, it's not going to happen. You know, you're going to be eaten up alive. And especially if you're in federal court going up against the feds and you got the U.S. attorney there. Again, if you get the knowledge, I will assure you the knowledge that we've offered and just the things I just told you, if you really go and do your homework and get involved in all those things, okay, first get the framework, and then you have a place to put all these papers and forms. And we have a structure. Also, we teach in the structure of like an anatomy of a court case. So you should be able to find that also underneath education. Might be on that page, as a matter of fact. I'm looking to see. I'm pretty sure it is. An anatomy of a court case. Pretty sure it's on there. If it's not, I'll get it on there. I'll come back and look a little later, but got a lot of stuff there. There are certain cases you should really read. Okay, U.S. versus Williams is a very important case. Marbury versus Madison, extremely important case. Miranda versus Arizona, a very important case. Okay, that's an empowering case, Miranda versus Arizona. And we have those. These are landmark Supreme Court cases. So you can go up there and take those papers and read through them, take some notes, cut and paste, build your case. Okay. But again, if you're going to go in ignorant, I promise you, you're going to lose. It's very rare. You could go in pretty ignorant, and if you have a jury there and you're able to articulate yourself well and make your position. Remember, the one thing that they have to prove against you in any case, if they're coming out against you, is willfulness, your intent. What is your intent? If you had no intent on injuring or hurting anyone, of course there's such a thing as neglect. That's not necessarily criminal, of course, but it makes you responsible. If you don't have any intent to do evil to anyone and they can't prove it, and you can show you didn't have intent, and that's why letter writing and answering is so important. You got to make sure you get your intent in every one of those letters to the IRS or to any government agency. And so when you put yourself together that way, you'll be strong and good. But you have to make the point of not being what your intent really was, building that case for intent starts the very moment that they start to come and assault you. Immediately your response to them has to be to build on what your intent is. Build the case. Okay, again, all these things are available. And I know that people may come and use these documents and not be prepared to really be able to use them because they're taking a shortcut and they don't want to get educated or whatever it is, they don't get educated. They hurt themselves more. You're better off going getting yourself a lawyer and make a deal and pay the toll and move on. Otherwise, you can end up in jail depending on the case. Another question?
Yes. If an employer has just decided to honor a worthless computer-generated notice of wage levy letter instructing them to steal a large
portion. I'm sorry, start that over again.
Okay, if an employer has just decided to honor a worthless computer-generated notice of wage levy letter instructing them to steal a large portion of one's earnings, and if that employer is too intimidated to even read the law, then is there anything one can do to influence the IRS to lift or release the wage levy?
Well, the very first thing you do is notice and demand to your employee and to the IRS. And let me tell you something about the IRS. If the IRS is going to levy your account, you should have stopped this long before that happens. And that happens by responding to their letters. That's where it begins, okay? And when they go to tell you, you know, that they do this by certain authority, again, you know, next week we're going to look at the IRS paper, okay? And when we look at that IRS paper, you're going to see a lot of answers or information that you can use in your case to defend yourself. For instance, they don't have the authority. They don't have the authority or any right to question you about anything. You don't have to produce any personal papers or books or open your pocketbook to anybody, okay? And if you're building your case with a letter writing back and forth, again, putting them, you know, controlling the narrative, putting them onto the defensive, And even if they just keep bombarding you with the letters, answer each one of them. Sometimes I answer them with the same darn letter, you know. But as long as it's got to be notarized and certified to paperwork and connected to the letter that you're responding to, you got to keep a good record. So that's one way to protect yourself, because they're not going to go out after you until they finally trap you into, come on down, talk in the administrative process, and we'll try to work things out. And you get down there, and then they'll have you sign the paper. And you know you shouldn't sign the paper, but a lot of people will be intimidated, and they'll end up signing the paper. And guess what? You just sold your soul to the devil. You're done. You're finished. It's over. Okay? So you got to be real careful with that. And again, if you acquiesce by a year or 2 years' worth of papers, they're going to move it along. They're moving it along through the process, and you're acquiescing. And when you get into the court, you're still acquiescing in the first 15 days. Once it's passed, you're done, you're in, and you're not getting out of it. And there are a lot of other tricks they play anyway. So, you got to protect yourself, and you could do a notice and demand is what I would do concerning that, and you build your case. And if you don't know about a notice and demand, you got to learn. We teach that up on our educational page. Again, you can get that information. Everything else has to be with it. You have to have a proper framework of your mind, an understanding of the Constitution and the connection between our three founding documents and the understanding the authority that they have and the authority that they don't have. That's what that government by consent course is going to teach you, give you the framework. And then you do the rest of the stuff, as I mentioned. Also, I strongly, after you get to that point, okay, when you really got the basic knowledge, okay, even if you think you don't remember it, that's fine. It's up there, okay? But even if you have once you get that basic knowledge, that's when I strongly suggest to get a hold of Brent Winter's book, Excellence of the Common Law, because you'll have a really good appreciation of that book once you have that other knowledge. And I think that's an important prerequisite, but not necessarily so. His book stands on its own also. But I think you'll have a heck of a lot more appreciation because you'll know our founding fathers and what they've been talking about, what they've said, and what the law is and the Constitution. I mean, and everything is there, you know, and that's what common law is all about. So, anyway, that's that. Okay, we're not going to take any more until next, maybe at the end of the evening, if we run out of people talking, we'll answer some more questions. If not, we'll try next week. And then the following week, if we keep getting too many questions and we're not getting to them, then the following week maybe we won't have any subject to start off with, and we'll spend more time with answering these questions that are coming in. Okay?
Okay.
So, with that, let me see, is Gerard here? Gerard, did Gerard come in tonight?
I'm here.
Okay, you want to take the board? after I introduce Brent?
Yep.
Okay.
By the way, huh? Yeah, I got it.
All right. By the way, give me a call tomorrow sometime. We need to talk. We've got numerous issues to discuss.
I know. I've been so screwed up. In
this. Building up. It's getting there. It's going to knock you out, man.
Yeah. I just got in, too.
All right. Do you think you're going to be taking Wednesdays? I know you can't do anything this week, but do you think you're going to be taking Wednesdays?
I think Wednesday is the day. It's hard. 2 hours is hard for me during my work day. That's the only problem.
All right, let's talk tomorrow, and I'll try to spend some time and take you into the program and show you what I've done, what I know on how it works. And it's pretty simple. There's 3 or 4 things you really need to know. And you may be a little awkward in the beginning, but it'll become more old hat as time goes on and
we'll
work it out better. Okay, so let me move over to Brent, and I'll back off here. We're going to turn the microphone over to Brent Winters. He is, again, the author of The Excellence of the Common Law and many other books. He's also the author of The Militia of the Several States, which we have used to make a course on, by the way. So if you're not aware of that course, that's a course, Ken, you need to take because you are a member of the militia, whether you know it or not. And that course, which is really Brent's almost entire book, okay, is really going to make that point clear. So Brent Winters, his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you, John. I'm here. This is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. And as I say on the radio show, coming to you from the low side of the Wabash River. I listened to Stan Monteith for years, and he'd always say on his radio show, coming to you, we're looking beautiful Monterey Bay. He had a nice home up on the side of the hill there, apparently. And I thought, well, he was being honest, so I'll be honest. I'm from the swamp on the other side of the river. But here I am. This is Brent. We're talking about the militia. My comments are my own, and may or may not be the views of National Liberty Alliance. I was thinking, as John was talking about civil procedure, we have completed 2 courses on Saturdays, both 45 weeks long. We meet once a week. The first course was on the common law of evidence. The second one for 45 weeks was on the common law of contracts. And then we're going to, Lord willing, do another course. The next one will be due process. In the law schools, they call it civil procedure. It's not all that civil. Usually there's quite a fight going on. I just like to call it due process because that's what our common law calls it. The Magna Carta called it law of the land in the Latin tongue, lex terra. Due process, the process that is due and owing to all concerned. Fair play, right to be heard, right to notice, and a meaningful opportunity to be heard. Well, we're going to do a course on that, Lord willing, and that'll be, and this time we're just going to do 15 weeks or so. 45 weeks
hey,
is
Brent.
Too long. Yes.
Hey, Brent, look at why don't you get those links to those pages where people would go and give us a little paragraph on each one of them. We'll create a page and put it under our education where people can now come and get a further education through what you're doing. Okay?
Oh, that's a great idea. I'll do that. And I was going to say it would be helpful, as John was talking before I came on, it'd be helpful if you took the civil procedure course that he has, or not he has, that in, and I think it's the jurisdictional course or something. I don't know, John, you can correct me on that, but there is a course there. And
it's called the jurisdictionary course.
Jurisdictionary.
It was much better off when I took it because I got all the materials, and now he's changed it around where the materials are up online, but I'm sure you could probably download it. And it is a good course. But you got to, take things with a grain of salt. He's got some errors in there in his thinking. He's not as constitutional as he should be, but he does try to be. He sounds like a good guy, and he's got a lot of good positions, thoughts, and ideas. But that course does cost, I think it was $325 is what I paid for it. And I did do it over a weekend, so it's possible to go through that course in a weekend.
Wow.
And I pulled all the notes and everything, and I created a book for myself, which became a reference book, two thick booklets that I put together. And but I had a little bit of background and understanding of some paperwork. So, but in any event, it can be done quickly. But we do have some information similar to that in our... and I want to clean that up and make it better. Matter of fact, I might even write a book called The Anatomy of a Court Case. And that goes through a lot of paperwork and responses and different things that take place and, you know, causes of actions and all those different things that you need to kind of understand if you're going to get involved in a case and write your own papers. So, but I'm sure with what we have on our website and what Brent is going to be offering and has and is offering right now, those courses that he is going through and teaching. Between all that, you'll have some good materials, enough information. But if you want to get that course also, I would do that. But then, you know, do that course last because you'll have a good foundation if you do this stuff first and then do the jurisdictionary course. But I think you'll find that, you know, we cover a lot of the stuff that's in that jurisdictionary course. Brent, back to you.
Thank you, John. Well, that due process, it's not... Due process is the foundation of our legal tradition. Due process does not stress what ought to be done. It stresses how it ought to be done, and that is our common law. It is a course of process. It is not result-oriented. It is process-oriented. We don't say, okay, here's the result the government says we got to reach. That's what the rest of the world does. That's the foundation of the law tradition called the law of the city. Our tradition, we call it our common law tradition nowadays, the most important thing is that we get on the course and we concentrate not on the result, not reaching a particular result, but concentrate on the course. We call it fair play. We call it due process. The Bible calls it the way, W-A-Y. Pilgrim Progress, John Bunyan called it progress. He got on a path and he stayed on it. That's what the book is about. And in the Older Testament, the Newer Testament says the way, which means the roadway. The Older Testament talks about the path and the course. Those are all different expressions of that first principle called our common law. It's a law process. Our Constitution doesn't tell us what to do as much as it's telling us how to do it. Read through it. You'll see. Well, it tells you how government is supposed to operate, the course it's supposed to take. And then, of course, it puts limits on it. And one of the limits it puts on government is what we today call the militia. Well, I'm supposed to, and I haven't done it yet, but I've been encouraged to give a five-minute oral presentation on the history of the militia. Not going clear back to the beginning of the world, but just go back to the tribes. The tribes that, for whatever reason, by providence, delivered our common law to the island called Britain, and then it came to America. And those were the angels, the Saxons, and the Jutes. And those three tribes had what we today call the militia. But in their Germanic tongue, they called it the Fyrdfer. Fyrd was their word for armed band of men. And fair, we still use that word when we say welfare, or we say fare thee well, that means to move along in a good way or to progress. Like Pilgrim's Progress, it means to progress in a positive, not a negative way. And the Fyrdfer was the militia a-going. That's the way to translate that old Germanic phrase, the militia a-going. And our militia is our word for the Fyrd, and it was part of the law of Britain after those tribes got there. And they said, even back in the 9th century, at that time the law was that if you're within any particular shire, S-H-I-R-E, when the Normans came in the 11th century, they had the French tongue, they'd learned, so they began to call it counties. And we still call them counties, but the shire and the county are exactly the same thing. But if you were within any shire for 40 days, didn't make any difference where you were from. You could have been from France, or you could have been from Scotland, or you could have been from Ireland, or you could have been from Wales, or Cornwall, or Yorkshire, or London. Wherever you were, if you were in one of those shires, the Shire of Kent, for example, south of London, for 40 days, the law said you had to go put your name on the roll of the militia. Now, I said shire. It got down to where they really were organized more tightly than that. The shires were made up of what we call today townships, traditionally 36 square miles in America, give or take. But they didn't call them townships back then. They called them the hundreds, H-U-N-D-E-R-D, the hundred. And they called them the hundreds because the hundred was an area of land traditionally that would embrace enough folk that there'd be 100 men able-bodied to bear arms. That was called the hundred. The hundred even had its own court, which was below the county court. But the hundred became the building block for the militia, as the townships ought to in America today. You ought to register locally at your township, and then the townships would be organized into the counties. Well, I've been reading. That's the history of the militia, of course. That whole idea came to America. It was in England. By the time William the Conqueror got to England, he ruled. The first thing he did after he conquered England, the first thing he said was, every property owner, law requires every property owner to procure a longbow and a minimum of 40 arrows. A longbow and 40 arrows. Now, by principle, of course, that would translate to us as a firearm and X numbers of rounds of ammunition. The principle hasn't changed. The equipment changes, but the principle doesn't change. The law never changes. If it's true law, it never changes. It's just applied in a different way to a different set of facts. That's all. That's the fundamental of our common law. Well, of course, that idea then stayed with England, and the militia was always there. Granville Sharp, the New Testament Greek scholar of England, he said, after a long study of the subject of the militia in England, the Furred Fair, this was back about the time our country started, he said, and I'm quoting it pretty close, he said, there never was a time in England that able-bodied men were not required to be armed. Never was a time. In other words, there are always able-bodied men, our law, required to be armed. And he said not only to be armed, but to be expert at arms. Well, what does that mean? Well, somebody told me, well, it was my brother when we were little boys. He said, Brent, he was always thinking. He ended up being an engineer. Thinking too much when we were supposed to be working. He'd say, X is the sign of the unknown, and a spurt is a drip of fluid under pressure. He said, I think that that would make an expert an unknown drip under pressure. Well, when you apply that word to expert witnesses, that's what you got, unknown drips under pressure. But when you apply it to using a firearm, the idea of Granville Sharp was that proficiency, that's the word, proficiency. Familiarity, that means you're familiar with the firearm. It feels natural in your hand. You've fired it so many times that you don't even aim anymore. You just kind of know where to point, like you're pointing your finger and you pull the trigger. That's what it means to be proficient at arms. There is no other way to be proficient. Taking a class is just a good start. After that, it just comes down to firing lots of rounds of ammunition until it becomes part of who you are, always maintaining a very close respect for the firearm. Now, these are things people don't talk about that are gunners much. I think they ought to talk about them more. You know, when men go to the service, they sing songs about their guns to try to drill this, and this has been something that's been learned over centuries. Drill the idea into you that you have, if you don't respect your firearm, you're going to get hurt or somebody else is going to get hurt. Cindy, Cindy, Cindy Lou, I love my rifle more than you. You used to be my beauty queen. This is what they used to sing. You used to be my beauty queen. Now I love my M16. That is intended to drill into the young fella the idea that his firearm must be a respected piece of equipment. Otherwise, he or somebody else could inadvertently get hurt or killed. It's fact. Bullets go where you send them. They don't have brains. So it's important, as Granville Sharp said, that every able-bodied man be proficient, ready, and willing with arms. Well, let me get to the model militia statute that we're reading here. This is in the back of the book, Militia of the Several States, our Constitution's answer to its enemies, both foreign and domestic. We went through last time the oath of the militiaman. This is a model state militia statute pursuant to the Constitution because, remember, the state legislature of every state is required, our Constitution requires the state legislature of every state to pass a state militia statute. Have they done it? I swear to support and defend the Constitution. All the state legislatures take that oath of the Constitution of the United States, because the Constitution requires it of all state and federal office holders. Don't have a clue what's in it. And fundamental to our Constitution is the militia. All the able-bodied men, as John said a while ago, you don't join the militia. Well, he didn't say it this way, but this is what he was referring to. He said, you don't join the militia. You are the militia. You're born that way. And when you get to be about 20 years old, that's who you are. And then it becomes incumbent upon you to do something about it, because the law of the militia, our Constitution and our Second Amendment and the other three militia clauses are informed by our common law. And at common law, the militiaman owns his own firearm, and he obtains his own training course that he may learn safety and proficiency, marksmanship. He can hit pretty much what he's pointing at. I've been to shooting ranges, maybe you have too, and you walk into the shooting range, it'll be inside a building, and the ceiling is kind of low sometimes, and it'll be full of bullet holes. Bullet holes! The ceiling! Because people, you know, they couldn't even come close. They'd bring the gun down, or the firearm, and the muzzle, and pull the trigger before they even got it level on the target. Is that natural? Yeah, that's natural if you've not fired a firearm. But it doesn't take long. You get good at it. You get progressively good. If you can point directly at something and pull the trigger. Let me read. We talked about the oath. In no event shall any other oath be required of any militiaman. Let me read it really quick. This is a model oath. I put it in here, and I believe it conforms to the requirement of the Constitution of the United States. I will support and defend the Constitution of this state and of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Foreign, yeah, that means armed defense. Domestic, that means jury duty. That's what that means. And upon being duly called and mustered into actual service of this state, will obey all lawful orders of the governor of this state and of the officers placed over me, and upon being duly called and mustered into actual service of the United States, will obey all lawful orders of the President of the United States and of the officers placed over me. And we stressed last time, it doesn't say that I will obey all orders of the president. It says that I will obey all lawful orders. And that's our common law tradition. People, I found this out when I was on the other side of the world, people in other military services, young men, take oaths to obey all orders. And I'd ask them, people from France, people from Thailand, people from Japan. By his signature and his oath, this, or the voluntary militiaman, shall accept the responsibilities of militia duty according to the limitations of the U.S. Constitution and its lawful delegations. Now, I say here, volunteer, because the militia has been sleeping for 150, 175 years, the militia clauses of our Constitution have been sleeping. as our law would call them, the dormant militia clauses. That's really true. Well, we don't want that. But right now, I don't know that because ever it's been they've been sleeping and most people have no sense of their duty, I say make the militia voluntary until the state legislature puts a statute in place that makes it mandatory, because our law makes it mandatory. As I said before, you are the militia if you're an able-bodied male over about 20 years old. Paragraph 7, this is the model state militia statute. Each militiaman, upon having been sworn into this state's militia, shall, within 1 year, purchase at his own expense or otherwise lawfully acquire the weapon and 500 rounds of ammunition this state's legislature has specified, and within 2 years of enrollment shall provide proof that he has, at his own expense, disciplined himself to safe handling of, care of, and marksmanship with said firearm, which meets the state legislature's standards. Paragraph 8. Any federal law, regulation, executive order, act, or action infringing upon the right of any individual of this state to keep and bear arms, or upon any other constitutional duty or responsibility rationally related to militia duty under our U.S. Constitution, shall have no force or effect over the members of this state's militia, regardless of whether any member in question is enrolled upon the militia rolls of this state. You see, the reason the Second Amendment says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed is because it is impossible for any law to take away a fundamental right or infringe upon it. As a matter of law, it's impossible. Is the right to self-protection and militia duty given direct to the individual from God? The answer is yes, from your Maker. The Supreme Court has ruled it is an individual right. They did that in 2008. Well, that being true, that was in support of the idea that it's fundamental, it's individual. There are no group rights in our tradition of law. There are no group rights in our tradition of law. All rights are individual. Fundamental rights are individual rights. There have been perversions of that in recent decades. It'll get us off, and we'll get really messed up. We start talking about the rights of groups and people. It's a right, a fundamental right, therefore, the law cannot infringe it. That's why the Second Amendment is there. Just to say that government will protect and not infringe upon this right, the idea is to limit government. Qualification, it says, paragraph 9, qualification of militiamen and officers. In no event shall any man be eligible to serve as a militiaman or as a militia officer of this state who holds citizenship of any other country other than the United States, owes or otherwise bear allegiance to any other sovereign on earth besides the Constitution of this state and the Constitution of the United States. Now, I would like to word that differently now that I read it. Citizenship of any country. Well, maybe I wouldn't. Let me just make this comment about it, though. The citizenship, to be a citizen of the United States, is a function of state citizenship. You cannot be a citizen of the United States unless you're the citizen of some state of the United States. Now, the 14th Amendment, as is said, our courts say, turns that upside down. And it says there is such a thing as a citizenship of the United States without any citizenship of any state. It's my studied opinion that that has never been true, and I don't believe it can be true, the 14th Amendment notwithstanding. It must and should be understood in some other way. But in all events, paragraph 9 here is to avoid what the law calls divided loyalty. What is divided loyalty? I'll tell you exactly what our common law says it is, because the cases have recognized this over and over, and they've said the same thing, and it's sensible. Divided loyalty, here's what they say. Divided loyalty is no loyalty at all. So it's a misnomer to call it divided loyalty. No man, said Jesus Christ, can serve two masters. He'll love the one and hate the other. Now that's the Savior of mankind said that. God in human flesh said that. So I take it to be true, and I take it to the evidence, the record of what he said to be true, on good evidence also, the best of evidence. And I've also seen it in nature. That's why lawyers are not allowed to represent two clients on both sides of the case. That'd be silliness. People try to do things like that. We've even had people run for president that were citizens of other countries. Have we lost our minds? Ted Cruz, a citizen of Canada, born there. He wasn't a natural-born citizen of the United States. Barack Obama, we don't know what planet he came from. We don't have a clue. It's been a mystery. They wanted to keep it that way. They didn't want us to know. They wanted us to fight about it and get us off on fighting the wrong standard for natural-born citizen, which we did. Ted Cruz, there were two other fellows running on the Republican ticket that were not natural-born. That's another subject, but I use that to illustrate this point here, that dual citizenship is madness, but it happens a lot. As though we can even allow such a thing. Well, let me get on with it. Paragraph 10, organization and choosing of officers. Here we go. For purposes of organizing this state's militia, the governor shall divide this state into three blocks of equally numbered contiguous counties, each of these three divisions having numerically equal numbers of counties as close as possible, and with the boundary lines between these three divisions running along a line as true east and west as these counties' boundaries shall allow. A northern division, a middle division, and a southern division. Now remember, this is a model state militia statute, and I can visualize states. They could divide it, have the lines running north and south. So the principle here is, though, divide your state up into three, maybe five, depending upon how a state would want to do it. Paragraph 11. The governor of this state shall be this state militia's commander and shall appoint with the advice and consent of the state senate one general militia officer to be his immediate commander. Should read, be the immediate commander of this state's, no, his, it should be his immediate commander of this state's militia. Now I use words and phrases in there that arise from our common law. You say, well, these are words and phrases from the Constitution of the United States. Well, they are. But the reason they're in the Constitution of the United States is because they are common law phrases that are centuries old. For instance, the governor of this state shall be this state militia's commander-in-chief. That's an old phrase going way back. We have it in our Constitution of the United States. And then I put in here, with the advice and consent of the state senate. I can trace that back to at least 1,200 years in our common law tradition. And that's about as far back as you can go, because before that, our Anglo-Saxon tongue had never been reduced to writing. So I can trace it right back to the beginning. Advice and consent. The advice and consent of the Witan in Old England. And that was the Witan, as an old word for white. It means white-bearded men. The elders. Well, what are the Senate? Well, the Senate is from the Latin word from which we get our word senile. Senile. What does it mean? It means old. It's the Latin word for an old man, senile. Senate. What is the Senate? That's the older fellows, supposed to be, with white hair and beards. Well, if they grew beards, some of them would be white, not a lot. But you do have to be a little older. You have to be 35 years old to be a member of the Senate. You only have to be 25 years old to be a member of the House of Representatives. So, advice and consent. In our common law tradition, the executive, whether you call him the president or the king, or whatever you call him, he was not allowed to act, is not allowed to act, even our president, without the advice and consent of those old men, elders. Advice and consent. So that's why I put that in here. Paragraph 12. After 30 days, but before 60 days of the enactment of this state militia statute, the militiamen, having been placed on the rolls of each township, shall elect by majority vote their own township's militia officers. Each militiaman of each township shall be entitled to one vote for any officer this statute empowers him to choose. The bodily presence of three-quarters of a township's or a county's enrolled militiamen shall constitute a forum for purposes of any vote taken to choose officers. Vote by proxy, telephone, mail, email, or any other way other than by secret ballot of those personally present shall never be allowed. You got to muster up to attend an election of the officers of your township. Paragraph 13. The enrolled militiamen of each township shall elect and appoint at the time and place their township supervisor designates by secret written ballot one officer at the head of their township. Paragraph 14. The militiamen of each township shall be divided into companies according as near as is possible, to contiguous precincts within each township, with the militiamen electing an officer for each company, defined as follows. Paragraph 15. Each township supervisor shall divide his township's precincts into contiguous groupings in fulfillment of this statute. Each company shall choose its own officer to be under the command of that township's officer. 16. Thus, any township enrolling 100 militiamen or less shall constitute one company under the command of the township officer of their choosing. Townships enrolling 101 to 200 militiamen shall constitute two companies of equal numbers, or as nearly equal as possible. Townships enrolling 201 to 300 militiamen shall divide into three companies of equal numbers, or as nearly equal as possible, with each company choosing its own officer to be under the command of the township officer. Townships enrolling 301 to 400 militiamen shall divide into four companies of equal numbers, as nearly equal as possible, with each company choosing its own officer to be under command of the township officer, and so on, as more numbers of enrolled militiamen require. 17. Each company officer shall further divide his company into squads of 12, and he and no other shall choose and appoint one petty officer over each squad. Township officers, upon being chosen and appointed, shall, within 1 month of their appointment and by the governor's writ designating the time, assemble at their county courthouse and shall each cast one secret ballot for commanding officer of their county's militia. The bodily presence of three-quarters of any county's enrolled militiamen shall constitute a forum for purposes of this vote. Vote by proxy, telephone, mail, email, or any other way other than by secret ballot of those personally present shall never be allowed. As soon as ballots are counted and the results determined, the man receiving the most ballots shall be the commanding officer of that county's militia. Each ballot shall be counted in the sight of each militiaman having voted, and he shall acknowledge the person chosen on each ballot. Let me drop a footnote here. Now, here we have an overlap of terms. When you're talking about the able-bodied men of a county, you're talking about the posse comitatus. The posse comitatus. When I'm talking about the militiamen of the county, that's what I'm calling them, or that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the posse comitatus. What is the posse comitatus? Well, that's, again, that phrase comes from the Normans. The Normans were Norwegians who had settled on the coast of France 165 years before they invaded England. Well, while they were on the coast of France, unfortunately for them and for us, they picked up a form of the French tongue and bastardized the daylights out of it, and that's what they spoke. And that's why we have funny words in our legal tradition today, like petition. That's a Norman-French word, and we have all sorts of other funny words that we use constantly I've got a whole list of them in that comparative law book, Excellence of the Common Law. Some of them have become commonplace. But the posse comitatus is a Latin-based word, and posse is the Latin-based root for possibility. Possibility means potential. Potential means potential power. Comitatus means county. That's their word for that jural division called a county. So the posse comitatus is the potential power of the county. Well, who's the potential power of the county? It's that band of able-bodied men that live in the county. Well, the militia, see, there's an overlap here. The militia of a county is really the militia of the state. When we're talking about the militia, we're talking about an ultimate state, an ultimate state group of men of a state. But the counties, of course, are an easy way to organize them. That's why the posse comitatus is an important expression of the militia. But there is an overlap of terms and persons. It's the same bunch of guys, the able-bodied men. Paragraph 20. Within another 30 days of the conclusion of the deadline for electing commanding officers for each county, all such county commanding officers by the governor's writ designating the time shall assemble at the state capitol building, where each officer shall cast his secret ballot for an officer to serve over his division of contiguous counties, such as the state legislature has provided for herein, and directly under the governor and his appointed state militia commanding officer. And again, the bodily presence of three-quarters of the state county militia commanding officers shall constitute a forum for purposes of this vote, vote by proxy, telephone, email, mail or email, or any other secret written ballot, for those present shall never be allowed. No more militia officers other than these designated above shall be chosen and appointed. Well, we'll read a couple more paragraphs of this section, and then we'll quit. There are three paragraphs here. This is under the section called Calling Out and Mustering into Actual Service. This state's legislature shall provide criteria mandatory for the governor to use in deciding whether or not any purported necessity warrants calling out the militia of this state or any part of it. The governor of this state may summon and muster the militia of this state or any part of it into actual service to execute the laws of this state, the laws of the United States, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, but only according to the criteria this state's legislature has previously provided for the governor to use to make such decision. Paragraph 24, and this is the end of the presentation today, in no event shall any militiaman be summoned and mustered into service of the United States other than to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. That's a quote from the Constitution of the United States, Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16. And only according to the criteria Congress has provided for the President to use in deciding whether or not the circumstances in question warrant calling out the militia of the several states or any part of them. Now, that is the requirement. Our Constitution requires in those militia clauses to provide to the Presidents of the United States a criteria to use to know when to call out the militia, execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. You see, the President doesn't have authority to say, well, I want to call out the militia to execute the laws of the Union. No. He is only to do that under a standard that Congress has provided. To execute the laws of the Union, there has to be a certain triggering event, some kind of an insurrection, some kind of an invasion, some kind of a breakdown, and Congress is supposed to put that in place as a standing order to the President of the United States so that he does not abuse calling out the militia to achieve his political purposes or to crush his political opponents or any other blasted excuse he might think of. Gerard, I'm played out. If you're able-bodied, able-voiced, okay. You're up.
Very good. Thank you, Brent. That was good. Okay, we got some callers in the calling section there. And it's 10:59, so that gives us an hour. And right now there's only four, so let's see. We'll get going. Anybody else wants to get in, get in. Speak now, forever hold your peace. Okay, we got Jeff from Florida. You're up next. You've been unmuted. Go ahead. Hello, Jeff. No. Well, looks like my mic is working. I don't hear Jeff, though.
Going yeah, on. I hear you.
Yeah, I don't see any life down there in Florida. Okay. I'm going to just leave you open. I'm going to go next to JoJo Baby. I don't know what's... I'm going to unmute you, Joe, and let us know where you're from and your first name.
Yeah, Sportsman's Warehouse.
Oh, hello. Hello?
Oh, who's that?
It's JoJo Baby, Eddie Joe.
Right. I just opened you up. Yep.
Okay, great. I guess my comment a little bit goes a little bit earlier into the meeting about the being able to bear arms and how they take that away from you if they pin an infraction on you, like a felony, whether it be an actual crime or not. And then so they take that away from you. And then they also take away your right to vote. There are some states that give it back to you after you get through your whatever courses, but there's a lot of states still out there that even take the right for you to vote away. And I think that's a travesty in itself. And definitely has kind of put a damper on me ever wanting to hunt, you know, because everybody's kind of wrapped around that concept of protecting the borders when the man says that you're not allowed to have something. And I don't know. That's a big order to try to fill. That's a lot of people standing in the roadway, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm willing. And then about the militia part, there was some kind of maybe age limit on that-ish. Like up to the militia.
Yeah, it's been changed a couple times. I mean, we're saying that it's around 20, but I think, you know, years ago they used to say like from I think it was 17 to 50 or something like that.
See, okay, good, because I'm almost in the loop. I'll just I can start to revert here in a couple years because I want to be a part of all of it, you know. I mean, if my country
it doesn't mean if you're over the age that you can't do anything. It's just that there's a requirement for males between the age of that they can actually be summoned. It's like being drafted into the service. If you're
right,
it's part of what you do to be part of this country and enjoy the freedoms. You have an obligation. So, you know, like Brent says, rights come with obligations.
Right.
So that was the obligation. Now, just because you're not obligated doesn't mean that you can't do it. You can't volunteer. Cool. You know what I mean?
Right. And I'm happy about that then, too. And if you look back to the Shires, back then they were defending their neighborhoods. I can't remember... Well, actually, the last time we defended our neighborhoods, but all our boys that get drafted into this, the military or the weekend warriors, they go somewhere else and fight on different people's land. And I mean,
well, the National Guard really is not supposed to be going overseas. That's a misuse of the National Guard. I mean, now they take them and they've made them part of the army, the military, and they're using them overseas. But really, that's a misinterpretation or an abuse of what the National Guard is. They're not supposed to be. They're supposed to be here on our soil.
Can you imagine hearing this? I'm sorry, Ms. Smith, but there's been misinterpretation with your son.
Yeah.
Yeah. Try to take that back. Yeah. So I get that. I'm not asleep. I've seen what's been going on in our world for a little while, and it's kind of will make you throw up in your mouth a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. Until I found the National Liberty Alliance, I thought I was like one in a couple hundred, because I would talk about this stuff and people would just call me cuckoo. I'm glad to have found you guys, and I'm so wanting to be a part of this and get kicked in. So thank you for everything that y'all do to help strengthen our country and help guide some of us that are still needing much guidance.
Well, I'm glad you found us, and that's part of what we do. And don't forget, you know, you got a big misinformation system out there, and they are what's making us think we're weird or we're in a minority, and that's the job that they do. And it's a lie. It's a lie.
It is.
And you know, I remember years ago they used to say it used to be the silent majority, and then in the 60s the big bumper sticker was the silent majority is neither. In other words, they're neither silent nor they're a majority, not a majority.
Right.
That's what the hippie movement, I guess it was at that.
Liberated some of that notion. Yeah.
But look at nothing. There's nothing new under the sun. Nothing changes, and so basically, it's the same things that go on over and over again, and we don't learn from our mistakes, because number one, like now, they're rewriting history. So how can you learn from your mistakes when they change the they change the history? So
right.
You know, and they say the one who wins writes the history.
Right, the victor writes the history, and it's a travesty. Yeah, earlier when the meeting started, John was talking about how our kids our younger generation are just not knowing about communism and, you know, fascism and all that. But if you look at the majority of the people that are raising their children, they're raising them in that type of environment, really, that the kids are moving back home in their 30s, and the parents are doing everything for them. And so it's kind of like mini communistic villages inside there. And I hate to say this, because I tried real hard with my son, but he's entitled.
We know socialism doesn't work and communism doesn't work, but the only place that communism does work is in the family. A family is a commune, and you do give to each one, each according to his needs, each according to his ability. But you can't have that in business, and you can't have that in the street. It just doesn't work. Look, you do a lot of stuff for your blood that you're not going to do out in the street. You're going to take care of your family in a certain way. And you look, as a parent, you never turn the child away. I don't care if he's 50 years old, you're going to try to take care of him if he's having a problem.
Right.
But that's the right thing to do, and that's the communal thing of the family.
But the influence...
You can't run a country like that. You just can't.
But the influence of society on the outside of that is turning that mentality, at least with my son. I am a single mom. I ran my own business. I had to do everything. And so he got really used to me doing everything. And so he doesn't...
Well, do it like a true communist. You're the dictator.
I'm not.
For the dictator.
Oh, I hate being a dictator.
You know, they don't have respect today. They don't, you know, it's pick and choose. It's not, you know, look at, they're not really, they're breaking down the authority of the parents. The state has usurped it, you know, and they've changed the law to say that the state is the primary educator of the child. And that's where all these problems come in. So,
right. If your parents are doing something or you smell some weeds, don't forget to tell on them. We'll take you out of the house and throw them in jail, but that's better for you. Yeah, so obviously that's a whole other wicked to get into here.
It's time for us to get back to basics and look, it's the people. It has to start come from the people. If the people, you know, don't do it themselves, it's not going to happen. And I don't remember if it was Jefferson or Madison, he said, this government is only for a moral people. You have to have morals.
Yeah.
In order for the republic to work. And you know, you notice on when you listen to any of these politicians and these talking heads, they're always saying, our democracy, sure, because that's the mob rule that they want to push. That's the dictator. It ends up in being a dictatorship. And so that's what they're always touting. Democracy. We're not a democracy. We're a republic. And there's a reason for that. So anyway,
thank you again.
Yeah, coming on, and we'll be looking forward to hear from you.
Thank you.
Go through and educate yourself on our materials. Lord knows we have enough of them.
I'm all over it. I am.
Okay. Thank you very much. The next person is a 928 number, no name. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I am trying to deal with a court situation.
Give me your first name and your state, just so that we can...
Joe, Arizona.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so you're trying to deal with a court situation, a court case, what?
Yes, I was driving a truck, and when I was stopped, I told them I was a traveler. They broke my window, arrested me, damaged and stole my property. And I filed a lawsuit.
Wait a minute. You told them you were what when they broke your window? Oh, you told them you were traveling. You were not driving. Is that what you said? Is that what you mean?
Correct.
Okay. And so they broke the window right away. They got, yeah, because you can't tell them that stuff on the side. Look, they're schooling these officers for certain keywords. And if you say certain things, they've been told that you're a sovereign citizen and that you're dangerous and that they should use anything they can. So it's not a good place to educate the police on the side of the road, because look at it's like one of our first mentors said, there's nothing so frightening as ignorance in action. They're ignorant. But they have the guns and they believe the right to use them on you. So, you know, when you say, well, I'm not traveling, I'm not riding, I'm traveling, you do all that stuff. First of all, those guys, you know, I don't even know, you know, what kind of education they have, but if it's a public school education, which I guarantee most of it is, they have no idea what you're talking about. So, yeah, they're going to beat on you, they're going to jump all over you, and then, you know, and then you go in and tell it to the judge, and the judges, you know, they're educated a certain way, and they got the Southern Poverty Law Center telling them, you know, these things and
well,
labeling.
Well, they never filed charges, so the case is vacated.
I'm sorry, and you broke up. I didn't hear it. Repeat that again.
The case was vacated because the police never filed charges.
No, well, they probably figured that they did some things wrong and they broke your window and whatever else they did to you. So maybe they just
let me get this up to date here. So in the interim, I filed a lawsuit. The police had never responded. I requested for a foreign registration, which they do not have, and they never responded in to the court, so a default order was put in.
You filed the that. Call. You filed it with the county.
Yeah.
Oh. So what was your wherefore clause? What did you ask for?
Well, I was asking for compensation for violation of rights and also damaged property. They stole my computer, burned up the motherboard. They stole my phone.
So you had a dollar amount on the bottom for all this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was that dollar amount? Was it high or was it, what was it?
$100,000.
Well, $100,000 is very reasonable today because they carry insurance policies on them. I mean, listen, if you're in business or even as a police officer, he's in business when he's on the road. You know, most people carry million dollar umbrella policies for liability, and they were liable. They defaulted, which means that they agree that they're liable. So did they pay you? You filed the thing. What happened?
No. What happened was is they hired an attorney because it implemented also the police department. And so the attorney took it to the U.S. District Court, and the U.S. District Court said that the police department could not be sued, but the police officers, who I was suing, was remanded back to the Superior Court. At that same time, the prosecutor filed a felony resisting arrest against me. And I told them that I'm a state citizen and that I'm not in contract with them, and to prove on the record their jurisdiction.
Well, that was challenging the jurisdiction was the right thing to do.
Well, they have ignored that. I sent an appeal in to the Arizona Supreme Court of Appeals, who sent back a denial of dismissing the case because they claimed that I was a person, which I sent a response back saying that a person is either a government employee or a U.S. citizen or a corporation, which I'm none of those. And February the 5th, the judge is going to go ahead without answering jurisdiction and had me go in for a probable cause. And he's going to set the arraignment March the 2nd. I demanded to see his oath of office and, you know, the FOIA.
Yeah, they don't care about that. Many of them don't, anyway.
And so I'm just wondering, since they're going to go ahead and try to, slam dunk me, I thought, well, maybe
the probable cause is the hearing that they have where they have to prove that they had probable cause to bother you in the first place, which I don't know why they pulled you over in the first place. Did they have probable cause? Which
well,
they can get it anyway. They can say, you know, you had a taillight out or something like that. Stupid, right?
Well, he claimed that I was ran a stop sign, which I didn't. I was behind a retainer wall sitting at the stop sign. And when I pulled out to see if there was anything coming from a stop, there was nothing, so I just kept going. And this cop come around the curb, and he saw me. He thought I just ran it. So he stopped me at the post office, and after that, that's when they, arrested me and towed my vehicle and, you know, what have you. But the point is what it is, it's a small town. It's Apache County in Arizona, which is only maybe about 2,000 or 3,000 people in the county seat.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that by several people that's been here for, you know, 30, 40 years, that they've even told people that's worked for them that if they try to expose the record, they'll kill them. And so I was thinking, well, they're just trying to turn my case into a frivolous case by finding me guilty. And, you know, so I'm at a crossroad here thinking, well, maybe it's best I just leave the state.
Yeah, well, look, their corruption is deep. And for you to try to get justice in a small community like that where everybody's bought and paid for is almost suicidal in a certain sense.
Yeah, you're breaking
up. You're not going to get justice there. And I don't know, you know, if you leave the state, they're gonna put a warrant out for your arrest if you get pulled over. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. The DA may be willing to make a deal. You know, if you tell them, look, I see you guys aren't gonna follow the law, so let's plea bargain this down to some kind of a disorderly conduct or something, because I don't have the gumption to fight you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but that then turns my lawsuit into a frivolous lawsuit. They want to give me probation. They've offered it several times, and I refuse it because that's involuntary servitude, isn't it?
Oh, sure. You know, well, the main thing is, you know, they're going to get you to take a deal, or they're going to put you behind bars, one or the other. That's where they're at.
Right.
You know? And as far as your lawsuit, you look at, they're basically coercing you into this in order to maintain your freedom. And they've right. already violated numerous things, so look, you challenge jurisdiction, they didn't answer it. That case doesn't really go away. You need to bring it up into a federal court or something, into another court out of the area, you know. And okay. it is a due process fundamental right that it should be taken care of in a federal court, because just, you know, you're the local court and the state court can't rule on that because they're party to it, you know.
Right. Well, that's what I also put. They were an impartial. Couldn't try me on an impartial, but they denied that the Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you what to do. You see, if you move it into a federal court for cause and get the judge to give an injunction to stop them, but I don't, you know, I don't know that there's, if you're going to find a federal judge that's going to do that. You know, Donald Trump has been replacing judges. I don't know who and where and what. You know, we spent a lot of time in the courts hoping to get a good judge, and we never really found anybody that was running according to the common law. You know, I mean, I had a personal case of mine where the judge found for me against a credit card company, and it was because he had some place to hang his hat and he became interested in the case, and it was no skin off of him. It was, you know, it was between me and the company, and they behaved badly and you know, the way I conducted myself and everything I asked for, and they didn't give me anything, and I kept insisting and sticking to my guns, and he ended up finding for me. But I think that's a very unusual, you know, that judge was a decent enough guy to see that I was making a case and that they were stonewalling me. And when they showed up for trial without a witness, he dismissed the case with prejudice. Now, you know, he was a good guy, because I think that they've been told you don't find against the corporations. I think that's very unusual that you know, if you go into a fight against a big corporation or a town or a city or anything like that, I think that there's maybe an unwritten or unspoken, but they all know it. They're never to find for the people, I don't believe, because I think that they've been told that you won't sit in that seat very much longer if you do that. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't know. I sent a reply to the appeals court that they would also be indicted before a grand jury with these others. You know, I've been pretty bold and pretty straightforward. And I've quoted.
Yeah, but ultimately, you should be in the federal court anyway. I mean, the state appeals court, they're probably not going to overturn you know, the local stuff, because they're, like I said, they all have a, I mean, not that they couldn't, they could, you're right, you get another swipe at the apple, but you at some point, that's how you get out of there, you bring it into the federal court, and that should stop them, because once you move it to the federal court for cause, they should have to wait to see what the results of that case are. But you need to get an injunction from the judge. And you might be able to do that, because they're jealous of their powers. So if you play them off right, that judge in the federal court might actually fine for you, because that's one thing that they like to do. Sometimes they like to squat the lower courts just to assert their authority over you, if you know what I mean. So if you could write a paper that basically does that or says that, you might get a federal judge to give you some kind of an injunction until you get done with the case. And that would be the best thing for you. And I'd move out of the county anyway in the meantime, because they're going to just look for another thing to get you. You know what I'm saying?
I know it. I was in asking for the bond at the treasurer's office, and he asked me, well, what's it for? I said, well, I'm taking a business law course, and I wanted to do compare bonds. And he said, well, let me get a hold of the attorney. So I know that once he called them, he said, no, don't give it to him. So, but the thing of it is if I could had a rough draft of filing an injunction, I could put the thing together and file it. If you could send that to me.
You don't want to have to ask John. I don't know if we have, I mean, if you're taking the jurisdictionary course, you can see the outline. They're all basically the same, and then you see.
Well, found out your website here a couple days ago.
You know, tons of information up there.
On my own.
But in order to file for an injunction, it's I'm sure it's a simple matter. You know,
so
what I mean?
I file it at the Superior Court.
Well, when you file in the federal court, in the federal district court, when you're moving it out of the state court into the federal court for cause. Now, for cause, you can only talk about those things that they did to you that violates your unalienable rights. You don't want to talk about anything else, because they'll throw it out. You know what I mean? I lost my train of thought here, but. Oh, at the time you file that case, within that case, you also ask for the injunction as you put the case in, that you need an injunction to stop them, to stop the action until the results of that case are seen. They should do that anyway, but I believe you could put it in and ask for it then. And I'll tell you what, the federal courts are much more client friendly, so to speak. If you go get up there and you talk to the secretary and you say, look, I'm going to file this, I'm going to move this case for cause into the federal court, but I would like to get an injunction from the judge, she may give you the form right there. We've had pretty good luck up in some of those courts where they actually take you aside and they show you how to fill things out. They're very much more helpful than the local courts. You
so
know?
If I just called the clerk at the district court.
Yeah, I would go in and see them. You know what I mean?
Okay.
If you first of all, you got to have your, you know, when you go in and you say, look, I want to move my this case here into the federal court for cause, you want to have some, it'd be nice if you could have it already written up, but she's going to tell you, she'll tell you, you know, the form that they wanted in, the spacing and all that other stuff. She'll probably give you a packet. And what you say is, well, look, I need an injunction also. Is that included in the packet? So I would just go up there and talk to them and see,
okay,
see
well,
what kind of information you
have. It's a 200-mile drive from here.
That's tough if you're going to, I mean, Maybe you want to proceed it with a phone call and see how you do with how friendly they are before you take a 200-mile drive over there. I understand that.
And you know, and so, the thing that is they already handled part of the case with the police department, so they should be familiar with it. But they remanded it back to the Superior Court for the police, and then that's as soon as they did that. they did a service, a summons that was defective, sent it to a wrong address, and then they had a warrant for my arrest, and I was stopped on the highway and hauled in, and I was there for about 2 weeks.
No kidding. So you already you're already been down through it pretty good.
Yeah, so you know,
give him a call. I don't know. We may be able to get you a form for filing an injunction. It's a simple thing, but I would call them and see, because, like I said, the federal courts, and you can go into, I think that you can go into any district you want. You don't have to go into that particular court if you don't want. You could pick another.
What district can I go to?
You can go to any of them in that area.
Well, there's only one in Phoenix and one in Tucson. Tucson's another 200 miles.
Well, you go 200 miles this way or 200 miles that way. See, we got a lot more. Like, you know, over here, you know, like ours are only about 100 miles away. You know, you got the Southern District, and then you got you know, the Northern District and the Western District. And they're not that far apart, but out west, I guess that's just the way things are. So I don't, you know.
Go anywhere here at the 100 miles round trip. But the point I'm trying to get at is that I just need maybe I can just call down there and have them send me a copy, and then I also ask for a waiver because I'm on Social Security, and just file it like that with an injunction.
Yeah, see what they say. Look, it's not going to hurt to call, and I think they have packets with that stuff in it. So get on the phone and see if they'll help you in that respect. And
okay, I'll
look at, and be in, and tell them, you know, sell them you're disabled, whatever you can tell them, make them feel sorry that they want to help you a little bit more, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
All right?
All right, sounds like a plan. And
okay, let us know how you make out.
I was just saying, though, that since they're violating the law and they haven't proven jurisdiction, that any judgment is null and void, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and when you move it to the federal court for cause, that's what you're fighting is the fact that they never proved jurisdiction. You know, they're violating your due process rights. That's the only thing that the federal court can answer anyway. So make sure that's the issue that you're putting in the federal court. Forget about getting arrested and the window breaking and all that other baloney. They don't need to know any of that. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's just minutia that's going to cloud the issue. And if you put it in there, you're liable to start getting into it, the temptation. So just put the facts, man, like Sergeant Friday. We want just the facts. And that's the facts of the federal case, which is your due process violations. That's all you want to talk about.
I think you should
have a pretty good case based on the, you know, the stuff that's already gone on over there.
Right.
All right.
Okay. Thank you so much, and I'll get on it tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Joe.
And where are you located?
Oh, I'm in the great state of New York.
Okay. And as far as these other courses, I had trouble navigating your website, and I was wanting to, I asked several questions, and I didn't get in. I even emailed the common law attorney, and I hadn't gotten any response, and I was like, I'm coming up here on March 2nd for the arraignment, and I thought, well, the only other thing I can do, since they're not going to cooperate, is just skate, because I'm not going to sit in jail so I can't do anything.
Yeah, well, I understand. I understand that, but I don't know how that's going to go for you. And look, if you got questions on our website, you should be able to get a hold of Jan or Carl. There's numbers on the site how to get a hold of them.
I did email Jan, and I haven't heard anything back yet. And I was like, I wanted to kind of get direction here, where I'm going, which way I'm going, because otherwise, I don't want to have to sit.
Well, Jan can't help you with your case, but we could tell you where things are. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that was what I was interested on the website. It's like I was looking for. I did see, I tried to, I joined as a member, and I made a donation, And then I tried to move to district court, and I clicked on it and said, you're not a premium member or something like
that.
Yeah,
so maybe it didn't take. Sometimes it takes a little while to take. You got to refresh the page and that. I would go back in and try it again. And if it doesn't, then you definitely want to get a hold of Jan. There's a phone number. Or Carl. I don't know if the Carl's number's in there, but Carl's our tech guy that can fix that if there's some kind of a glitch in there. Okay.
All right. Well, if there's an email, you can send me the link. So maybe it'll bypass all that confusion, and I can just go move right in and pull the district court file, get the form right there, and mm-hmm. and you know proceed.
Okay.
You know, I'm not one to dilly dally, and I've learned a lot. I've been studying for 2 years on the law, and I have all the case laws and all that, but it doesn't do any good in the superior court. In fact, they pretend like I never even asked.
Right.
So, you know, I've never dealt with anything like this before, and I thought, how can they be so blind when I've demanded it in writing, and I've done everything in writing, and it's like I don't understand. Maybe they should be indicted.
They're not running under the rule of law. That's what Trump says. We need to return the rule of law. So,
how do we get them to do that?
Well, that's what we're working on. That's why we're filing these papers in the federal court.
How can I participate?
By educating yourself and joining, you are participating. You can participate, you know, more if you come to the meetings and pay attention to the indictments we're doing and participate in that. I mean, we have a lot of different areas that you
if you
have time that you can put things in and you can work with us and you can learn while you're working too.
Well, that's what I want to do, but I'm having trouble navigating your site, and I can't get into anything. And I thought, well, if I can't do it...
Well, it sounds like you've got a glitch there that we need to take care of, because it's not letting you in the areas you need to go, because it's not registering that you're a premium member. I don't know when the last time you tried it is, but I would...
I just signed up the other day, Monday, or what was it, Friday.
And you log in, you make sure you log in each time you come in, right?
Oh, yeah. It's Chemo Savvy.
Right. So it should ask you your login, and it should accept it, and then it should say you're logged in.
Yeah. And it says I'm in, but I can't. It says it won't let me access anything.
And it says you're not a premium member.
Right. So
you're Joe from Arizona?
Right.
And this phone number here, this 928, that's your number? I mean, if we wanted to get a hold of you, that's the number we could use?
It's my cell number, yeah.
Okay, so let me see if we can figure out something. I can get somebody...
Give them the heads up, and so I can start getting in there and
yeah. I'm sure it's some minor stupid problem because, you know, something happened because nobody else is having trouble, so something happened with your... when you registered. We'll figure it out, though. Okay, Joe?
I appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank
Have a good night. Yep.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Okay. Dan from Carolinas is next. Go ahead, Dan. Are you there? I hear something, but I don't know. It sounds like a water buffalo moaning. I don't know. Hello, Dan. Oh, Dan is snoring. We put him to sleep. He's my last victim, too. I don't know. Dan! Hello!
Hey, Dan, are you awake?
He's got his headset a little off, maybe. I don't know. Oh, yeah, Dan is snoring. Well, there's nobody else in the queue. And we could let Dan snore till tomorrow morning if we want. Okay, Dan, you're on our recording, so I'm gonna go ahead.
We still have questions from the emails.
All right, let me end Dan because he's we're recording him snoring here. Okay, Dan's gone. What kind of questions do you have? Anything I can answer?
Well, we'll try one here. At the end of last week's conference call, Brett talked about Justice Roberts being in the judicial branch and the Senate is in the legislative branch. Who would resolve a dispute between the two separate branches of our three-branch government?
Between the legislative and the judicial?
Yeah.
Well, it sounds to me that I would think it would be the president. I would think it would be the executive branch because they're supposed to check each other, right? The Supreme Court, doesn't have, everybody thinks they're the final answer on everything, but they're really not. If you start a case in a regular court with a regular jury, that's the highest court is the Pettit jury. So, I know each branch can, and if I don't know if Brent is still on because he could probably answer that better.
But, I'm here, Gerard. But he was breaking up when he was asking the question. Can somebody repeat it now, Gerard? You don't break up for some reason. Can you tell me what the question was?
Well, the question is he said that you said, Justice Roberts is in the judicial branch and there's a controversy between the Justice Roberts and the legislative branch. Who proceeds over a disagreement between the Supreme Court and the legislative?
Well, there's a lot of disagreements between those two branches because the legislature passes legislation and the courts then set in judgment on it and pronounce whether they think it's constitutional or not, which is the same thing as saying whether it's lawful or not. And so the question then is, who trumps who? And the answer is neither one of them. And now, as I like to say, that a common law government, and that's the kind of government we got, at the state and federal level, with the exception of Louisiana, common law government is a perpetual, never-ending Mexican standoff between three parties, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and the executive branch. And neither one of those branches has authority to commandeer the other branch. And at that level, power is divided. The definition of tyranny is when all three of those powers have migrated under a single will. For example, if in pure republicanism is nothing but dictatorship and tyranny, because pure republicanism is the legislative branch is sovereign and has all the power. It has the judicial, it has the power to make law, to judge the application of the law, and to execute the law. But here in America, we divide, make sure those three powers are kept separate. And the only way to keep them separate is to say that none of them trumps the other. In other words, the president of the United States can do whatever he can get away with to the public. If he doesn't want to enforce legislation, he won't do it. And every president we've ever had has chosen what legislation he will enforce and what legislation he will not enforce. When I was in another life, when I was in politics, I remember Bill Clinton was sitting in the White House. And I had a list of all the congressional legislation that had been previously signed into law that he said he would not enforce. The one I remember most distinctly is the legislation that said that in every unionized workplace, there must be a posting, and it had to be so big, with letters so big, telling all the people that worked at that workplace didn't have to pay their union dues to the union. They could, if they wanted to, pay it to some other organization that they thought was comparable. Now, there are a whole lot of rules to go with that, but Bill Clinton refused to enforce that legislation because the unions were his great support, so he just didn't do it. Andy Jackson made the whole idea famous when some do-gooder missionaries decided that they didn't want the Cherokee to go to Oklahoma. They didn't want the Cherokee to go to Oklahoma. A lot of the Cherokee wanted to go to Oklahoma, a lot of them, because they knew that the culture wouldn't survive where they were. Andrew Jackson was president, and he knew that. As a matter of fact, him and his wife had adopted a little Indian boy. They understood the situation, and he said so. And so the Supreme Court finally ruled that the President of the United States could not order the U.S. Army to take the Cherokee and a whole lot of other tribes that people never talk about, the Choctaw and the Chickasha and the Kickapoo and the Shawnee, take them all to Oklahoma. Well, President Andrew Jackson said, that's nice. I'm almost quoting what he said. That's nice. The Supreme Court has made its choice. Now let's see if the Supreme Court can enforce its opinion. Of course, he was making the obvious statement, they can't. Why? Because he had command of the U.S. Army. They didn't. And that's the way our government is set up on purpose. No branch of government, legislative, executive, or judicial, has a duty to obey another branch of government if in their heart of hearts they believe that the other branch of government is unconstitutional in what they're saying. The Supreme Court of the United States has black robes and prestige. That's all they've got. They can command a few U.S. marshals that hang around the court. That's about it. The President of the United States has the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, and all of the alphabet soup bureaucracies, the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, ad infinitum, ad nauseum. And he can do pretty much whatever he wants. That's why he's at that position is the only elected office in our country, state or federal, that requires a natural-born citizen. Natural-born. The power is so great. But right. Nonetheless, the legislative branch doesn't have to do what the president says. Back to you, Gerard.
Okay. Well, I hope that answered the question. Thank you, Brent, because I had no idea. So, I think they should go out and duel each other. Go out in the desert and put a stake in the sand.
Well, the federal judge Tom Jefferson got after a federal judge, tried to get him removed from office, and the federal judge challenged him to a duel.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah, this is common back then. And old Jefferson just ignored him.
Yeah.
Well.
Smart man.
Yeah. He wasn't. Yeah, he probably did a smart thing. But that's common. And our Constitution of the United States, being a brief of common law government, nowhere does it say that any of those three powers of government, legislative, executive, judicial, nowhere does it say which one trumps which one. And there's a reason for that, because they are co-equal. I'd say I learned more about the Constitution when I was in high school. We had to take a Constitution test to graduate. And I learned more about the Constitution than I ever did in law school in that class. For a year, you take a class in preparation of this examination. And one of the things that stuck out more than anything I remember about that was that the three branches of government are co-equal. That means they stand separate and equal. They don't commandeer each other. They can't. Now, they often cooperate, more so than not. But that doesn't mean they have to. Why is that? Well, because the Constitution of the United States is as a tree rooted deep in the common law. And you got this tree called the Constitution. And out of the tree grow three branches: the legislative branch, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. Well, just like with a tree, none of the branches of the tree depend upon each other or are ordered about by each other. Each branch that comes out of the trunk of the tree exists on its own, and it taps into the tree and gains its own life, and just as the three branches of government, each of them separately, tap into the Constitution of the United States. But even more than that, these three branches coming out of this tree If you go into the woods, you'll see this, and if trees are not tended or not out by themselves in the middle of nowhere, they don't spread out. Why don't they spread out if in the woods? Because the branches are reaching for the sun. And by the way, they're competing. They're not just reaching, they're competing. They'll grow away from each other as much as possible and shoot as high as they can so they can get to that sunlight. And that's the way the three branches of government we're supposed to, that we have in this trunk of this tree called the Constitution will naturally do and do naturally do. But it gets more, even more than that, separated. Each of the justices of the Supreme Court operate utterly independent of the other justices and make up their own minds. And that is also should be true of every member of the legislature. And it should be true of that other, it's called a branch of government, that independent branch called the jury and then the grand jury. Independence and separation is the power of America, because with that comes freedom. It starts at the very top of our government, and every person should be independent of mind, independent of speech, independent of thought. And I know that causes a lot of problems, and there's a lot of crazy people out there. Some of them are on the benches. A lot of them are in government. But that's why it's important that we each, in our common law tradition, must make up our own minds, stand on our own two feet. Indeed, not a one of us will ever be able, when we're standing before the maker of heaven and earth, ever be able to say, well, the preacher told me it was okay, or the pope told me it was okay, or the priest told me it was okay, or my professor told me, or the Supreme Court said it was okay, or even after you get older, my dad said it was okay, or my mother. Well, maybe mom and dad were wrong. Because you can't, in the ultimate judgment, you won't be able to make that argument. No, it's you. You're all by yourself, and you have to have independent judgment. And our common law tradition is a tradition that insists upon that. All the rest of the world is under the law of the city, and that's not insisted upon. No, it's all you just do what you're told, and you get in the queue and get comfortable with that idea. And then, in the end, you can say, well, the government told me to do it, or somebody in power or prestige told me to do it, and it's okay. It's okay down here on land, you might get away with that. You know, in all that, the rest of the world, it's a complete defense to any crime that you obeyed the government. If you can show that you obeyed the government, you can't be prosecuted. Is that true here? That's why when you call the IRS and they give you bad advice and you lose a lot of money or you lose your house, they can't be prosecuted. No, you're responsible. You're responsible to make up your own mind. That's why police officers, of course, can't. Well, that's another story. I shouldn't stretch that out too far because that gets too ugly. They go too far with that business. I won't do that. But just to say this, you must make up your own mind. Back to you, Gerard.
Thank you, Brent. Okay. Jan, we got a few minutes. What other great question do you have there?
Well, this one would probably be a good one for Brent. Can a common law militia, under the restored rule of law, force jurisdiction over UN troops ensconced on our military bases ever since Obama sold our rights to the UN? Can POTUS rescind that agreement in time, i.e. before medical martial law may bring the UN blue helmets out from hiding?
We should never submit to speaking as though somebody sold our rights. That's impossible. I mean, I understand your point, and I appreciate you bringing it up because it is a problem. But nobody sells my rights. My rights are inalienable. Obama didn't sell my rights. That creature, whatever he was, whoever he was, is a deceiver. He's a buffoon. And he was an ignorant man, but he was crafty. He was controlled by wealthy men. He was a useful idiot of the evil empire. He didn't sell my rights, and it's impossible to do that. Don't talk that way is my admonition. Let's talk about, no, nobody can sell my rights. It's like saying, well, let me move on to the next point. The next point is this. Can the militia enforce against the blue helmets? Well, they could do that if the governor has the good sense to call them up, or the sheriff in your county has the good sense to say, wait a minute, there's lawlessness here, and I have a duty to stop it. But don't go out on your own. The militia of the several states is under the authority of the governor of the state, and under the authority of officers. Officers, they were reading the model militia statute, and that's what we should be moving for, because in that arrangement, that's the constitutional arrangement. The four militia clauses arrange it that way. Your duty as a militiaman, is to be ever ready. That means you must have a firearm. Your duty comes under the Second Amendment. Duty. Duty arises from law. What is the law? The law is, if you're able-bodied, you better have a weapon and ammunition. That's the law. That's always been the law. Remember, we were talking about Granville Sharp, and the law has always been the common law, and this is true for all men, that a militiaman must not only be armed, every man, every able-bodied man must be armed, and anybody else who wants to be, by the way. But we're talking about what the law requires. The law requires every able-bodied man to be armed, and not only to be armed, but to be proficient at arms and safe. And safe. No, we're not looking for lone rangers and cowboys. That's not what the law sanctions. This law sanctions authority and arrangement. An arrangement of authority. Authority comes from above. It comes down and it's delegated. All authority, Romans chapter 13, verses 1 and 2, all authority is from the maker of heaven and earth. All, bar none. If it's true authority, then it comes down, it's delegated through proper channels. And it is the duty of the militiaman. That's why this model state militia statute, get it into the hands of your state legislatures and say, look, you fellows have a duty and you're not doing it. Offer a bill before the legislature that says something like this. If you don't like the way it's said here, do it the way you want to say it, but get the principle across that they have a duty to pass a statute so that this authority will find a mechanism in your state. And if there's a problem, like blue helmets coming in and occupying and enforcing force upon the good folk of your state, that the militia can be called out to stop it if it is necessary and done according to the law. According to the law means that every person is subject, as it says in Romans 13, subject to the highest authority. And the higher authority you see yourself subject to, the happier man and woman you're going to be. That's the way God has made us. Where should your ultimate loyalty be then? Well, it should be to the will of God. How do you find the will of God? It's in His book. He has recorded His will in His book. And He requires that you understand the arrangement of His authority. Arrangement is the key word. What is that arrangement of authority? Well, the Bible calls it the kingdom, basileia of God, the basileia. And to see the basileia of God everywhere you are, to see that arrangement, say, oh, I see how God has arranged this man's house. This man here owns the house, and this is his wife. And if they tell me to do something while I'm in their house, I better do it, or I'm going to suffer the consequences. I'm spitting in the face of God. That's just one fundamental example. Children are to be subject to parents. There's another example. We are to be respectful toward judges. Whether you like them or not, whether they're right or not, or whether you disagree with them or not, don't talk back to them. That's the point. By the way, same thing with your mom and dad. If you're fortunate enough to have them, don't talk back to them. You may not like them. They may be nasty, but either you may be disagreeing with them, but whatever you do, don't talk back to them. Don't do that. God will get you. Well, that's the arrangement of authority, and it comes down in the militia as well. And this thing we call the militia, no country on the faces of our green earth, if it's green, it's not green everywhere now here because it's wintertime, but on the faces of the earth, no country has ever had a law that governs their militia as clear as ours, except ancient Israel of old. So the militia does have an authority. Your duty is to be ready. That means you're to keep an arm, that means a firearm, ammunition, and be safe. Procure a safety course and a marksmanship course and stand ready and encourage your state legislature to do something about it. And you can find some of that information in that little booklet that NLA has on there and the course they have. They have a course that goes with the booklet. Back to you, Gerard.
Bunch of magic button, Gerard.
He's fumbling for the...
looking for the switch.
Or...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm talking
there he is.
Away.
Talking away.
Talking away. Should have saved that breath for breathing, right?
I said, God forbid Trump has to call the militia. I don't know how many he could muster right yet, because I don't know that we've got them all rebuilt, but there may be more out there than we even know. But hopefully we can get it done. And as far as the UN goes, I mean, there may be some UN troops here, but technically any UN troops that we invited here, that we allowed here, they don't go off on their own. They're under the armed forces. There is somebody in the army or whatever that they have to check with. If they're going off on their own, then they're an invading force. Is what they are. So they're here. If they're here because we invited them here, then they're under the command of some general, some adjunct somewhere. They have to get his permission to do that. Now, I'm not saying that we can't have a bad acting general, because Obama made sure he got rid of a lot of the good ones. So I don't say that that couldn't happen. But I think as long as somebody like Trump's in office, that's not going to happen. And look, he could call in the armed forces against the UN if he has to, you know. So I don't think that that's too much of a worry, to be honest with you. And, you know, look at blue helmets coming over to America thinking they're going to do anything. That's suicide. I mean, if I was part of the UN, I'd change my helmet color from blue, because that's going to be a target that everybody's aiming for. And you won't be able to go in the streets even. So I think that's a non-issue. And I think a lot of this stuff, look at even this business in Virginia where they said they're going to go door to door and take guns, that's a scare tactic. It's never going to happen. I don't believe it. That's the last thing they'll do, because don't forget, we outnumber them 700-1, and the majority of America owns guns. You know, there's many, many millions of guns out there, more than the military has. And it's just not going to happen. I don't think it can happen, you know. I mean, and they know that. They know that that's a losing situation for them. If it comes into a shooting war or anything like that, if we don't end it right away, it'll be 100 years war. They'll never, it's going to be a guerrilla, it'll be a horrible thing. But they'll never have control. So anyway, we're getting down to, it's 12 o'clock on the dot, and there's nobody else jumped in the queue. So we can end it actually on time tonight. So with that being said, thank you everybody for coming out. God bless you all, and we'll see you here next week, and we'll continue on the fray here, so to speak. Thanks for coming, and keep the faith and keep going and do those things. Let's get going.
Good night.
Good night.